on Walt Whitman. And we will begin with the first presenter. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome. Walt Whitman. Well, how do we approach this? Well, we as theosophists would begin by looking at a quotation from Light on the Path. Grow as the flower grows, unconsciously, but eagerly anxious to open its soul to the air. So must you press forward to open your soul to the eternal. This is the flower of self-realization. And we see in the poet, Walt Whitman, the expression of that. We read about ideas that were formulated, but to better understand them, we need to understand the time and the person. Walt Whitman was born in 1819, so in Long Island, so in our minds, our conceptions of that place and time, we need to think of ourselves as our mode of transportation are of two varieties, walking or a horse. And that the land was raw, untamed, new. And he was born of that age in 1819. And coming from, you know, humble beginnings, poor, you know, father finding hard to find work, but having to become self-sufficient at a very early age, taken out of school at 11, and he learned to trade at 12. He was self-taught because of learning this trade. He became an avaricious reader, even a writer at a early age. And from 16 to 21, he taught school. He had become so literate. And that he began editing papers and moving from Long Island to New York. So he was very much looking for and placing before the public ideas that were very very raw at that time of patriotism, democracy. So he was presenting to everyone what was really lying beneath the surface. His experiences through his 73 years of life ranged from economic calamity in the 30s, 40s, the rising of the idea of slavery and freedom. And there became a wanting to express his ideas to the public. Now, his background, you know, because of his necessity at an early age to fend for himself and learning a trade, he was able to publish his first edition of Leaves of Grass because no one wanted to publish it, except Ralph Waldo Emerson read it and praised him publicly. But then again, he published it again in a few more years, and again, it really failed. But the world or the war broke out in 1861, and this again brought him into a new realm of life, and he spoke of democracy and during these years of death and suffering. And he found himself during this time of the Civil War helping and the wounded soldiers. He spent years doing that, but he had government work. And shortly after Lincoln was assassinated, he was greatly affected by this. But he had worked for the government, and each year he had been revising his Leaves of Grass and adding to it and adding to it his thoughts and ideas. And however, he lost his government job because his supervisor read Leaves of Grass and was greatly offended. He was fired. So this compilation of his ideas and thoughts had not really developed any real traction, but at the age of 54, he had a stroke. And then a year later, he had another stroke, and the publisher he had in Boston wouldn't publish his writings anymore. So he found a publisher in Philadelphia. And for the last time in 92, he revised the Leaves of Grass. And so by 1892, he had passed away. We look back on his life and we see how this life unfolded. And we see we see ourselves, and we realize that through some of these ideas which he has expressed, we turn to that self-realization of who we are. Now we find words of wisdom in many places, and in poetry they are found aplenty. He had wrote, if we are lost, no victor else has destroyed us. It is by ourselves we go down into eternal night. And as to you, life, I reckon you are the learner of many lives. No doubt I have died myself 10,000 times before. When he was 54, he had a stroke and he became paralyzed on his left side. A year later, he had another stroke, paralyzed on his right side. He moved to Camden with his brother. And there, in fact, he is buried today in Camden, New Jersey. We see in his poetry the landscape of that time, his poetry of Barnegat, his essays. You read his poetry, well, this is not poetry, this is a story. This is a picture of time. We only relate to that in any kind of poetry that we can relate it in ourselves. So as we read it, we realize that he too, as myself, is on a journey of self-realization. What is that self that I must realize? Well, in his poetry, He speaks of God, but that is not the anthropomorphic God that was very much thought of at that time. So therefore, he had provoked the ire of many. So that we find his poetry expressing the ideas of freedom, the ideas of new and boundless opportunity, and of a certain kind of freedom that is that was part of that era, that new becoming before, because in actuality, it was the becoming of a new nation. The 1800s were a very tumultuous time, and he was a part of that. So the idea is to look at his writings. We turn to one of his writings that we remember as a young child when we were caught in life with the death of one near us. We turn to a poem, "O Captain, O Captain. O Captain, O Captain, my Captain. Our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting. While fellow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But, O heart, 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 O the bleeding drop of red, where on the deck my captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead. O captain, my captain, rise up and hear the bell. Rise up for you, the flag is flung, for you, the bugle thrills. For you, banquets and ribbons, reeds. For you, the shores are crowding. For you, they call, the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. Your captain, dear father, his arms beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you fallen, cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My captain does not feel my arm. He has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in from objects won. Exalt, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mourning tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead. How can someone imbue the feeling of anything but through realization of something that we all have in common? This self-realization, this knowing. And Walt Whitman is the doorway to that. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've taken the opportunity here for this half of the presentation to start with a few things that some of his contemporaries said about Walt Whitman, such as William James, America's philosopher. He was a philosopher and psychologist, a contemporary of Walt Whitman, and author of varieties of religious experience. And he describes Whitman's optimism. He says, just a simple quote, "The supreme contemporary example of such an inability to feel evil is, of course, Walt Whitman." Another gentleman, Richard Bach, a physician and a well-known student of the human mind. He was also Walt Whitman's most devoted friend and the author of Whitman's biography. An excerpt from his book reads, "Thus it has come about that many persons today regard Walt Whitman as the restorer of the eternal natural religion. He has infected them with his own love of comrades, with his own gladness that he and they exist." And then in an article in the Theosophical Literature, in a series written by several students of theosophy many decades ago, there's the statement, interestingly, "As for Walt Whitman, he was a man of the soil, unpolished, uncouth, untraveled, provincial. His outstanding characteristic may be stated in three words. He loved mankind. A study of his writings, in a study of his writings, one will find a lot about universal brotherhood and a lot about religion per se, not a particular religion or church, but religion as in the stars, the planets, and the unity of all of life. This is his religion. This is what he promulgated. Okay, but what about other theosophical ideas? Was he familiar with the idea of the masters? Now remember, he was born in 1819. This is way before HPB had begun her public work and her travels. Although we couldn't say that Walt Whitman even used the term masters, he openly declared his belief in perfected men, where he writes of, there's one very small poem that he wrote, and there'll be other things, but one small poem that he wrote, the title of the poem is Perfecteds, with an S, Perfecteds. "Only themselves understand themselves and the like of themselves, as souls understand souls." That's one of those poems where less is more. Now, if we're talking about masters, and he did write about masters, as students of theosophy, we have to remember what is said in the philosophy, that they have always existed as a body. They all know each other, no matter what part of the world they may be in. They all work for the race in many different ways. In different periods, they may walk among the people. In other periods, they don't walk among the people because the people aren't ready for it, depending on the cycle. And they may be hunted as devils. They may be worshipped as gods, and they may even be crucified. So, that being the case, we would remind students that the idea of crucifixion is not unique to one religion, but there have been many saviors. And in his poem that we're going to recite, this indicates that he knows that. And so those saviors are Jesus of Nazareth, Krishna of India, Tammuz of Syria, Indra of Tibet, Buddha of India, Mithra of Persia, Quetzalcoatl of Mexico, Prometheus. These are all, there is the story of all of these teachers as having been crucified. So to the student of theosophy, one thing becomes clear about these stories that are common to all religions and philosophies, or to many across time and civilization. What is called their common history, in quotes, is their mythos, and it may or may not ever be proven that any of that happened in a historical moment in time. Because these are stories, they're exoteric stories fashioned for the mind of the time to perpetuate spiritual doctrines. So, as the transcendentalists were said to have arrived before HPB to till the soil of the Western mind so that it was ready for theosophy, so did Mr. Whitman share these ideas that were so more clearly and philosophically made clear by HPB. Now, think of if you're in, this is 1860, way before HPB was doing her public work, before the Civil War. He wrote this. The title of the poem is To Him That Was Crucified. So most of the people of that day immediately are going to say, okay, well, we know who that is. But as students of theosophy, let's read it. Between the lines, within the words. My spirit to yours, dear brother, do not mind because many sounding your name do not understand you. I do not sound your name, but I understand you. I specify you with joy, O my comrade, to salute you and to salute those who are with you. Before those who are with you before and since, and to salute those who are yet to come. That we all labor together, transmitting the same charge and succession, we few equals of different lands in different times. In different of times, we enclosers of all continents, all castes, allowers of all theologies, compassionators, perceivers with rapport of men, we walk silent among disputes and assertions, but reject not the disputes nor anything that is asserted. We hear the bawling and the din, meaning we hear the crying and the screams, almost like the Mahatma hears the problems of mankind. We hear the bawling and the din. We are reached by divisions, as in the divided people among themselves. We are reached at by divisions, by jealousies, recriminations on every side. They close peremptorily upon us to surround us, my comrade. Yet we walk unheld, free, the whole earth over, journeying up and down till we make our ineffaceable mark upon time and diverse eras, till we saturate time and eras that the men and women of races, ages to come, may prove brethren and lovers as we all. Is that a student of theosophy? He's a theosophist unaware, as we would say. Interesting along that line, as was said by the previous speaker. He eventually moved to New Jersey. When did he move? He moved to Camden in like the 1870s. So he was here in the Philadelphia area when HPB lived in Philadelphia. This was after he wrote all of this. We wonder in the circles of the educated and the literary, we wonder if they cross paths. We quote him. As his philosophy toward his life's work. These are the thoughts of all men in all ages and lands. They are not original with me. If they are not yours as much as mine, they are nothing. Sound familiar? So, To Walt Whitman, what is religion? Religion to Whitman is not a religion, but religion itself, fundamental and universal to all soul, to all of life. We'll quote him. He says, "I say the whole earth and all the stars in the sky are for religion's sake, not for a religion, but to be used as religion, the oneness of all. I say no man has ever been half devout enough. None has ever adored enough, nor worshiped half enough. I say the real and permanent grandeur of these states," he's referring to the United States, which is still in formation, still informing. "I say the real and permanent grandeur of these states must be their religion, as in their unity. Otherwise, there is no real and permanent grandeur, nor character, nor life worthy of the name without religion." So, as we said, not a particular religion, but a universal religion. So we'll finish up. We found a very interesting quote in the theosophical literature, which took a quote from one of Whitman's writings, and they compared it to an excerpt from a letter written to HPB by one of her teachers. So way before he could have ever lived near HPB, he said, "Beware of churches. Beware of priests. Above all things, the flights and sublime ecstasies of the soul cannot submit to the statements of any church or any creed." Really, what has America to do with all this mummery of prayer and rituals and the rant of exhorters and priests? I demand something far more real than that for America. I say that today, the mummery of the churches in which none believe but all agree to countenance is what stands most in the way of a real religion for these states. And then here's the excerpt from the master's letter. And the master says to HPB, "I will point out the chief cause of nearly two-thirds of the evils that pursue humanity ever since that cause became a power. It is religion under whatever form and in whatever nation. It is the sacerdotal caste, the priesthood, and the churches. It is in those illusions that man looks upon as sacred that he has to search out the source of that multitude of evils, which is the great curse of humanity and that almost overwhelms mankind. Remember, the sum of misery will never be diminished until that day when the better portion of humanity destroys in the name of truth, morality, and universal charity the altars of false gods." So this gives us, hopefully, a taste of course, the universal approach to life and the discoveries that he made as a man on his own without our teacher on the scene. And it also demonstrates that in certain ways, in his own way, he was a teacher on the scene for many in preparation for what would become in just the next few decades, the reintroduction of the theosophical movement in America. So these are some of the ideas to present, and any contributions and questions are certainly welcome. SL.
Sure. Just to point out again that that poem that was read, "To Him That Was Crucified," is quoted by Mr. Judge
Oh.
in the notes to the Bhagavad Gita in its fullness, around page 51. Around page his notes on chapter 2, it's there in quotations. And he goes on to say that this work of tilling the soil is still going on, and that falls upon us, that just perhaps just as Whitman was preparing for the mission of HPB's mission, we who are devotees and sympathetic with those aims and purposes still have a lot of work to do to root out the weeds, the false ideas, first at ourselves, while we present those ideas to those that want to hear them.
Thank you. So, yeah, so this poem is verbatim, apparently, in the teachings of Mr. Judge. We didn't realize that. And serves as an example of the work that they were doing. And as the contributor said, that work continues to go on. And that's what we're here to do as students of theosophy, to share these ideas, to weed the issues out from within our own nature, and in doing so, to also, of course, help others move on as well by sharing these ideas with them. In the back, there's a hand.
So he may have been a provincial, but he was certainly well-read and well-versed, no pun intended, but he was. And he must have absorbed all of those vibrations of the day, which the Second Great Awakening, all the homegrown religions that mainly sprouted up in New York State, mm-hmm. in the Western end, including spiritualism, Seventh-day Adventism, Mormonism, and we think probably Swedenborgianism too, which was quite popular back then, all precursors of, forerunners in a sense, of theosophy. So is there any kind of anything out there that he, does he claim any influences, or is he just a natural mystic that kind of just absorbed it through his lifestyle and his compassionate and sensitive being, which he was? And perhaps he was a celibate, we don't know. Not that that really makes a big difference, perhaps, but, you know.
Sure. So the question essentially is, like, is this all coming from within his own intuition, or was he schooled in different philosophies, which brings to mind one thing that was said about okay. So we'll save that for later. He intuits a lot about himself, about his own nature, the nature of the human being in particular, which are theosophical ideas that are taught, which were, he would come to see within gross physical matter, he would come to see that there were finer states of matter concealed within it. That living beings' identities doubtless are near us in the air that we know not of. That's a quote. Interiors have their interiors. Exteriors have their exteriors. The eyesight has another eyesight. The hearing, another hearing. And the voice, another voice. So he is moving toward trying to find the words to explain the higher self. And here he mentions something there is more more immortal than the stars, something that shall endure longer than lustrous Jupiter, longer than the sun or any revolving planet or the radiant brothers, the Pleiades. He would write, "The body permanent, the body lurking there within thy body, the only purport of the form thou art is the real," what he would call the "I myself." That is he, what he, how he described what we would say the higher self.
Well, we also see that this was his journey. And it's the same journey that all of us are on, of self-realization. And it's sort of an outward expression of what lies within. You know, when one of his favorite poems, Song of Myself, the very first few lines sums it up. "I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you." So it speaks to us. And you know, we have to find that same love. That what is he trying to express? You know, what am I identifying with? So that's what poetry is. It's sort of like a song, a chant, and a hymn. So as Wes was said, you're invited to explore for yourself, because a self-realization is an awakening. An awakening to what? Our universal self, our oneness, our connection in the beauty of life and of nature and all around us. So we see that in Whitman's writings. He was in love, you know, with life and that around him. SL?
We have that expression in the philosophy we heard, to be in the world, but not of it. And we think of all the poets of that time, all the transcendentalist writers. He was probably the most who was in touch with nature, and in his writing showed his love and appreciation of nature, not just the natural body of the human being, but the nature around him. But at the same time, he was a transcendentalist. He taught, along with this physical journey of life, there was the spiritual journey. And therefore, we might even say he was a expounder of the heart doctrine, not to run off into isolation for one's own individual salvation, but to experience, to walk among humanity, and at the same time, not lose sight of our common unity.
Thank you. You know, there's one excerpt from his biography from Dr. Buck that to the student of theosophy just demonstrates his appreciation of the divine in nature. And Dr. Buck's statement is, his favorite occupation seemed to be strolling or sauntering about the outdoors by himself, looking at the grass, the trees, the flowers, the vistas of light, the varying aspects of the sky, and listening to the birds, the crickets, the tree frogs, and all the hundreds of natural sounds. It was evident that these things gave him a pleasure far beyond what they give him or far beyond what they give to ordinary people. So there's a kind of an appreciation for nature that was above and beyond. We have a hand. Yes, VW.
We could probably even find looking at transcendentalism in a what seemingly kind of an inspection to suppose what there is to it. That it's something that I understand started in New England and specifically has affected American scholars and clergymen's relatives who could probably be very well guided back into his actual poems, back into a narrower scope than what transcendentalism is going to do for us, which is skillful, I think, on his behalf, the way he's right to kind of confirms the transcendentalist he is.
Thank you. Yes, so the contribution here has to do with the different ways that these transcendentalists reached the people, reached the common people. Thank you. Yes, Esau.
And yet he was still very controversial in his days, and as was said, many refused to publish him. But what we've observed in the 20th century, in the late 60s and the early 70s, and even now, that his writings are more popular than they ever were during his time. They seem to resonate more with the modern mind, which is learning to free itself from a lot of the dogmatism and narrow-mindedness that he spoke of.
And isn't that the mark of a genius, that the music he writes, the paintings that they paint, the poetry they write are often a century or two ahead of what the mind is, what the collective mind is ready for. Thank you. Here in the lodge, we have a hand.
So what was it about his writings that nobody wanted to publish? I mean, if they were about nature, and I mean, he wasn't like a oh,
Well, the comment would be that we'll look at the world as it is today, and it was not much different in that time, and that his writings were of self-realization, and he admired the human form. He admired life. He admired the stars. He admired beauty. To the provincial mind, it was offensive to speak openly of those inner explorations, and it included sex. And that alone turned many, away because they in themselves could not reconcile that element of themselves. Well,
yeah. So he wrote of certain things that were considered outside the moral structure of quote unquote good society, and so he was
what
castigated
Mike just
because
said.
of that. The hand is up. Yes.
So was he an advocate for like women against slavery, any of that?
We saw some writing about yes, against slavery, absolutely. We don't recall seeing anything about feminism or anything like that.
Well,
Yes, SL or MDW had a contribution.
no, SL.
SL.
So another one of his more famous poems is the Body Electric. And in there, he speaks of the glory of the woman as the contributor to civilization. And there's nothing greater than a woman who brings forth, inspires their fellow men, works as a companion. And he also speaks of the equal and glorious opportunities of men and women He also, in that poem, speaks of the beauty of the African American race and the travesty of slavery that was imposed on him at the time he was writing. So, of course, all those things contributed to his controversial nature at that time, but yet today would be is taken up and appreciated by those who struggle and fight against those limitations.
Yes, we do recall reading that he was along the lines of the abolitionists.
Yes, and he had very early in his life, it was the free land and he was really for a democratic kind of society, and he sort of embraced that idea of democracy, you know, as a tenet of a society.
Yes, here at the lodge.
So before public education was universal, which really didn't even start until the 1850s, it's amazing how many individuals educated themselves, had a little bit of schooling. They learned the basic rudimentary skills. And in the society of the time, you could go from place to place to place and observe artisans at their work and put yourself forward, almost like an indentured servant for a while, and gain a skill, whether it be printing, carpentry, shoemaking, just so many skills that nowadays they're automated. And so it's must have been a very interesting time. And of course, his lifespan, the canal building, the railroad building, the telephone, the phonograph, he lived through all that. And just must have been an amazing time to live in.
Thank you for the contribution.
Well, it was a time of also that was very tumultuous. You know, the Civil War took place. It began in 1861, and he was very much affected by it. He even went, he became a nurse, you know, to help the wounded. So he had a very compassionate nature. And as was said, he was very sensitive. And we see that in his poetry. His love. Yes,
well, this is more of a reflection of this student that for those of us who live in Philadelphia, we know full the magnificence of the Walt Whitman Bridge. And we always wondered why, because it's more of the more modern bridges, why it got that name. You know, we can understand George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, but when we think that it spans Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, which we know he spoke about, and Camden, where he lived, we can see the bridge between the two states. But we don't think we'll ever cross that bridge again, thinking of it the same way, because in a way, his writings are a bridge for us, are they not?
Mm-hmm.
Between the West and the East, kind of on Toscarana. Between the two minds.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that comment.
Yes, here in the lodge.
His house is still standing. It's near the bridge. It's not in very good shape, but it's still standing.
His home in Camden in is Camden. Still standing. Yep. And didn't he have a home here in Philadelphia?
No.
Maybe it was a little museum dedicated to him. Yeah.
Just dedicated to him.
The chat.
Okay, yeah, we have a chat. The Rosenbach. No, it wasn't the Rosenbach Museum. It was actually called, I think it's the Walt Whitman House or something. No, we can't remember what it is, but it's not far from Center City. And then was
Whitman
there
Plaza.
a was there a hand? No. Okay. Yes, I saw.
Just hold this whole month as we think about the transcendentalists. Very often we study philosophical movements of the past, the great history of Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Hinduism, but and we fail to appreciate the philosophical richness of the West, especially in modern times. And it's just wonderful that we can now appreciate the basis, the philosophical basis, and the reach of a truly American-born philosophy that has worldwide impact in our modern times in the transcendentalists. And just meant one to mention that.
And in our time, in our space, Walt Whitman, his concern was for the future of what he called the states. And that's how he referred to America back then. When one referred to the United States of America prior to and maybe shortly after the Civil War, it was in a sentence, it would be the United States are, such as they are several states. And eventually it changed to the United States is. But he was very concerned and focused on the value of the United States adopting this universal religion, which actually was entirely consistent with how the founders were. They were deists, not necessarily the church. You know, it's not a religious, so to speak, country. But still, there can be the universal religion that people recognize as the value of. That's what he wrote about, which is theosophy,
Which is within.
which is within, and which can be seen without, if one sees it within, and vice versa.
That what we see without reminds us of what's within. So, as we look and search, we just try to reconfirm with life, that there are other minds that see the world in the same way. And H.P. being and Mr. Judge and Mr. Crosby, became a comrade in understanding the world and how we approach it and how we be in it. There's a chat.
Right. Despite our imperfections, we are still the place that everyone wants to be moving forward.
Yes,
Thank you for the contribution. So with that, we have come to the hour. It's 12 o'clock, and we thank you for coming. Hopefully, we have all experienced something that gives us reason to take a look at the poetry of Walt Whitman with our theosophical goggles on. And perhaps see a little bit more in him than we did when we read him back in high school.
Well, we only can state that bloom as that flower.
Thank you.